WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest, Han Ong, is one of the youngest people to have won a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. He's a playwright who grew up in the Philippines and moved to the States with his family as a teenager. He's written a new novel called Fixer Chow, which satirizes the lives of the upwardly mobile in contemporary America. The story is told from the point of view of a gay Filipino hustler who meets a social climbing but failed writer. The writer creates a scheme to get back at the successful people he most resents. He enlists Chow to pretend he's a master in the art of feng shui, the art of arranging furniture and other articles in a room, to create a sense of harmony that will lead to a larger sense of harmony and success. But instead of creating harmony, the writer wants Chow to create a disharmony that would undermine the well-being of his unsuspecting clients. Here's a reading.
His plan was very simple. He needed me to pretend to be an expert on, what else, feng shui. That way, he could take me into a series of homes owned by those people who formed the circle he so detested. In these people's self-projections, they appeared as colorful characters given distinct outlines by private areas of expertise. Admin, screenwriters, Wall Streeters, realtors, magazine editors. But really, they were nothing more than blind lemmings with the instinct to follow. And what they all seemed so eager to get behind was this new trend. They fancied themselves to have artistic sensibilities and or sympathies who talked about inspiration and the muse as things more concrete and vivid than anything from their hidden pasts, and therefore had a natural predisposition to believe in the unseen. And if this unseen was given the weighty cultural imprimatur of 2,000 years of Chinese civilization, well, that was as good as gold.
What's your understanding of feng shui?
My understanding of it is that it is, on one hand, it's the art of placement. It's the way by which good energies can be encouraged to come into your household or your office by arranging the furniture in such a way that energies can sort of flow freely.
Do you have anything against feng shui, like the guy in your novel who sets up the scheme?
No, I don't have anything against feng shui in particular. I just thought in my perusal of magazines and newspapers, when I have come across reports of feng shui and profiles of practitioners of feng shui, I've always thought that the leeway for fraud was so big in this kind of endeavor that it has always surprised me that nobody else has thought of that same thing. And so, though I have nothing against it, and though I believe some of the precepts are pretty solid, I thought that it would be a great point of entry to talk about the way we live now, and that's sort of my engine, my motivation in using this.
Like the main character in your novel, you grew up in the Philippines. Were your parents from there too?
Yes. My parents were born and raised in the Philippines by, you know, their parents who had moved there from southern China. And I grew up there. I lived there for 16 years before coming to this country to live in Los Angeles for 10 years before transplanting myself to New York.
When you moved to the States, did you find that people were confused about your ethnicity?
Yes.
Let me stop and say when your main character meets somebody in the book who doesn't even know what the Philippines is, he's never heard of it before.
Right. Yes, I have met people who have not heard of the Philippines before and don't know where it is and don't know what it is. So, so that part is definitely not an invention.
And your character also goes through people always wondering, well, what's your ethnicity? And he says, I started to say yes to anything. Are you Dominican, Puerto Rican, Brazilian? Yeah. Is that a phenomenon that you encounter?
Yes, I have experienced that myself. And I think, you know, just like my character, I have found it, so much easier to say yes. And because these are primarily strangers who sort of who ask these questions, and I don't think it's particularly useful to go into your whole life story to explain yourself to somebody who you will never see again. So I have said yes to quite a few things. I've been asked whether I was Native American. I mean, I'm tickled by it. I don't think I'm insulted by it. I'm tickled by it, and I recognize that I was speaking with an actor friend of mine just yesterday, and I was saying how lucky and fortunate he was that he had a face that could be seen as being from any number of races, and that he would therefore be able to play any number of roles, that he wasn't hemmed in by a distinctly Asian look, for example. And so I thought this was, you know, it tickled me that people mistook me for a variety of races, but it just allowed me more freedom, I guess, to sort of like slip in between categories. I thought it was an advantage.
The main character in your novel, Fixer Chow, is basically a street hustler who becomes this fake feng shui expert. And I know you ran away from home when you were around 18, I think it was.
Yes.
And you became a street hustler yourself?
No, I hung out with those people. I because I was their age, they felt free enough to sort of, and I was always curious. And I think you make a 180 degree swing from what you were taught to believe and have subsequently found to be untrue, which in this case now is Catholicism. So I made a 180 degree swing, and I found myself hanging out with these quote unquote disreputable groups. And I was just interested in their, to me, bravery and their heedlessness in this way of living. So I hung out with them. I gleaned stories from them. And I sort of just listened to them talk and justify their ways of living and soaked this information up.
Your character has spent time in New York as well, and he says, "In New York, I had fallen in step with the young, directionless, poor homosexuals who were my peers and had supported myself the way I'd seen them do, congregating at the Port Authority and places like it, where the smell of disinfectant and of urine mingled to form a boozy perfume that had the effect of turning every sordid action unserious, lightweight." First, I'll say I think that's very well written.
Oh, thank you.
and second, I was surprised by how you thought it turned actions into very unserious, lightweight actions. That boozy perfume of urine and disinfectant.
I believe that if you do that for a living, you have to operate from a very narrow bandwidth of consciousness. You can't really be aware of all the negative ramifications of what it is that you do. Or if you are aware, you have to filter it through some skein of mischievousness or maliciousness or some kind of odd, twisted, inverted joy. You know, I mean, I think if all of us were to take stock of our lives, especially if you were at the very bottom rung of the economic ladder, you wouldn't be able to go on. And so I thought that was a very accurate way of describing how these people, out of survival, you know, later earlier on, in the book, I believe I say that the character recognizes that he was stupid when he was doing those acts at the Port Authority restroom along with his peers, but he recognized that it was a stupidity adopted for survival.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is very true of these people.
You had been living a life that you kept hidden from your parents for a number of years. What are some of the things they learned about you from your plays?
I think they learned that 13 years of Catholic education had all gone out the window. It only validated their idea of me as already a fully formed individual, even as from the womb. I was just so willful. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to talk about these things that in polite company, and specifically in Asian culture, being a rather polite and a culture more focused on the virtues than on the flaws of human beings that you shouldn't talk about, you know. But I was determined to talk about these things.
What are these things? What kind of things?
Homosexuality. My characters are you know, in this book, the narrator is homosexual. Not only that, he perpetrates a scam or is a willing participant in a scam. And these are not exactly marks of good citizenship. But nonetheless, I talk about, I deal with the ramifications of having a character who's unsavory, and I don't blanch from it. And so these are, you know, they like the fact that I'm successful, but they don't like what it is that I write about. And so there is a contradiction, a paradox there that they haven't quite come to grips with or assimilated into themselves.
Here's what I'm wondering. You speak in what strikes me as a fairly formal, very analytical, kind of intellectual way. It's hard for me to imagine you speaking in the voice that you're speaking now. when you were a teenager and hanging out with hustlers in New York and L.A.
It's my writing voice. I call it my writing voice. It's the voice in my head, the way I speak now. That is, I call it my writing voice. It's the voice in my head when I write, when I look at things and analyze things and phrase things. It's my prose voice as opposed to my dialogue voice. The dialogue voice that I use is looser. That's the voice I use in playwriting. It's looser. It's more prone to malapropisms because characters do not speak in well-turned-out sentences. However, in prose, I found out that even though this novel is purportedly narrated in the first person, I just had a lower tolerance for misusage of words and for imperfect phrasings and for, you know, kind of slippery writing. And so that's sort of the voice that I now have. I don't know if that's for better or worse, but when I just speak, you know, to people, it's, you know, I just use my regular voice. I'm not even conscious of adopting a voice. It's just, you know, it comes naturally to me now when I write prose. It's the voice that that gets in my head when I read a lot of books and when I'm writing.
So is the voice that you've been using during this interview what you think of as your writing voice?
Yeah, it's my book voice because I'm in the middle of writing something right now, and so I tend to be analytical and it's almost as if I'm thinking of the phrase before I say it, you know, editing myself beforehand. And so now I find myself, because of my experience editing, being a little bit more careful when I speak because I realize that, you know, it's committed to, you know, to tape, to the page. And so now I have to be more wary and careful. So I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing because it's nice to make room for you know, idiomatic poetry, or for the casual sort of unintended insights. But
well, you don't want to go through life too self-conscious.
Exactly. But unfortunately, that's, you know, the writing voice now. It's sort of the writing voice. I call it the writing voice.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Han Ong is the author of the new novel Fixer Chow. This is Fresh Air.